Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Trust excellence built on 40 years of experience. Visit zurichcorporate.ie to learn more about the Zurich Master Trust.
Greg Allen, thank you very much indeed for that. Now, it's been reported today that Ireland and Spain are prepared to recognise Palestinian statehood as early as the 21st of May. The UN is also set to debate a draft resolution tomorrow to allow Palestine become a full UN member at the General Assembly. Joe Biden has also warned that the US would halt weapons supplies if Israel moved into Rafah, where 1 million Palestinians are sheltering, as you know. Rashid Khalidi is the founding co-director of the Center for Palestine Studies in Columbia University and the author of books including The 100 Years War on Palestine. He came to prominence last week addressing students outside the gates of Columbia University just hours after NYPD officers raided Hamilton Hall to remove demonstrators who occupied the building in protest at Israeli actions in Gaza. You're very welcome indeed.
Well, I think it's another chip in the wall of denial of Palestinian rights. I think it'll have an impact on Israel. It'll show them how isolated they are in an increasing segment of Europe, and it'll encourage the Palestinians. I don't think it'll have any material effect in the short term, certainly.
What do you think needs to happen for that to be achieved, though, beyond just a mere declaration?
Well, I think that the elites in European countries and the United States have to respond to the wishes of their peoples. Increasing numbers of Americans and Europeans oppose Israel's war on Gaza, want a permanent ceasefire, and want movement towards Palestinian rights on the part of Israel.
I just wonder how that the end of that conflict will come about. I mean, for decades, we thought that the solution would be a two-state solution, but I don't know where that stands now.
You know, I'm a historian, Cormac. I'm not going to be able to predict the future. I have no idea how we get out of this. I know that Israel has done everything possible ever since the 67 war to make a two-state solution impossible, building settlements, exporting 750,000 of their citizens as settlers into the West Bank. So I wonder about those countries that talk about, those governments that talk about a two-state solution, which refuse to talk about an end to occupation, which refuse to talk about the settlement and colonization of Palestinian lands and the takeover by Israel of most of the West Bank. If you don't deal with those issues and you don't allow the Palestinians to choose their own representatives, you're not really talking about a Palestinian state. You're talking about extension into the indefinite future of the status quo of colonization and land theft and Israeli control.
Is that likely, though? Is that likely that you'd get the end to the illegal settlements, the end to Israel's military occupation, the receding of borders, and a two-state solution? It
certainly
seems from current rhetoric that it's unlikely.
I think that unless and until public opinion is able to force governments to do the right thing. And public opinion is moving in the right direction in all of the countries of Europe and certainly in the United States. And there's a poll out just today talking about how overwhelmingly Democrats and independents consider what Israel is doing in Gaza to be genocide. This is quite striking, 56% of Democrats. And you go through the other issues, overwhelming support for a permanent ceasefire, overwhelming opposition to what's being done to students on campus, and so on and so forth. I think that we're moving in the right direction, but I think you're going to have enormous resistance from elites, from the people who, you know, dominate most Western societies, to changing things. I don't think this is going to happen quickly, in other words.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that when you say we could be moving in the right direction, you could also argue the contrary, couldn't you, that since October the 7th, the atrocity of what happened on that day and the military response from Israel, you could argue that any type of solution is way, way further away now, given the trauma that's being suffered by all.
That may be true. I think that the atrocities that Israel has committed and the horrible, horrible things that were done in the days after October 7th have hardened views on both sides, among Palestinians and among Israelis. You have well over 40,000 people dead in Gaza. You have over 800 Israeli civilians who were killed on the 7th of October. I don't think it's going to be easy for either society to forget that trauma, as you put it. But there have been instances in the past where things have changed very rapidly. Israelis were completely opposed to giving up Sinai. But in 73, the war shook their sense of certainty, and a few years later, Israel agreed to do that. The same thing happened with the First Intifada. Israelis were completely determined to maintain the occupation as it was. The Intifada shook that and led to Oslo. Oslo did not end up being a solution, but things changed very rapidly over a number of years as a result of trauma and shock. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it might happen here.
Can I go back to what you alluded to earlier on, that this isn't just a conflict between the way we reference it sometimes, Hamas and Israel.
Right.
And it's interesting to note, isn't it, the efforts by the US Secretary Antony Blinken and the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the UK, David Cameron, their efforts to bring about restraint or a peaceful settlement. But you mentioned those powers, the US and the UK, in the long history of this war, really.
Nothing that has happened since 1917 could have happened without the efforts that the British Empire made to suppress the Palestinians and to encourage the development of the Zionist project. Nothing that has happened since 1948 could have happened without the United States massively supporting Israel from 11 minutes after Israel's establishment and Truman's recognition up until $160 billion, the largest single delivery of foreign aid to any country by the United States, in mainly military aid to Israel. Every bomb that's dropped is an American bomb. Every plane is an American plane. Every helicopter is an American helicopter. The United States is party to this war. So is Great Britain. It is now and has always been. And much of Western Europe is also complicit. So without that support, without these Security Council vetoes, it's not just the bombs. It's the political and diplomatic support. It's the echoing of Israeli rhetoric by the American president, by the British prime minister, by German and French officials, that enables and encourages and allows Israel to do what it does. Without those things, Israel could not do any of this.
So where does that leave efforts to broker a settlement then?
Well, I think it's up to public opinion to force their leaders to do the right thing. Public opinion has shifted in most countries in the West as a result of this war. Everyone was horrified by what happened on October 7th. Everyone was and should have been even more horrified by the 25 times as many civilians who have been killed by Israel since then. There has been a revulsion. In spite of the horror at what happened on October 7th, there has been a revulsion at the way in which Israel has waged this war, dropping 2,000-pound bombs on heavily populated areas to kill one Hamas leader and kill dozens and dozens and dozens of innocent civilians.
But
people have turned against that.
But when you say, I apologize for intervening, but when you say it's up to public opinion to change that, even on your own campus in Columbia University, there have been protests that have been quashed, for want of a better word, because there are allegations that it's creating a toxic atmosphere for Jewish students who have nothing to do with the conflict in the Palestinian territories. And then on the other side, you have claims that it's quashing free speech and free protest. So how do you bring about a change in public opinion if protests are allowed or not allowed, based on your perspective?
Well, I think that the protests have had a positive effect in many cases. A number of universities, unlike Columbia, have agreed to at least consider the protesters' demands. And in Dublin, Trinity College has agreed, to their enormous credit, to the protesters' demands. So I think that this is pushing this issue into the public sphere in a way it was never pushed before. Has it some negative aspects? Of course it has. Are some students uncomfortable? That is unquestionably the case. I would add, nobody talks about how uncomfortable Muslim and Arab students have been made to feel. We have an anti-Semitism task force. We don't have a task force on Columbia's campus to deal with the enormous number of incidents that the university has refused to pay any attention to, where Arab and Muslim students have been harassed, in some cases sprayed with foul chemicals.
Yeah, there should be. You're right to point that out. That should be outlawed. But also, if Jewish students are feeling uncomfortable, that should be outlawed as well, surely.
Of course it should. And there is an anti-Semitism task force appointed by the president to deal with that. So I'm not suggesting that there's not reason for some students to feel uncomfortable. The point is, students on both sides have been made to feel extremely uncomfortable and harassed. And that should be dealt with on an equal basis, instead of one set of complaints being treated as if they're sacred and another set of complaints being completely ignored.
Do you think the authorities in the US have been, and on college campuses, have been too hard line in terms of quashing pro-Palestinian protests?
Unquestionably. They're driven by right-wing politicians. They're driven by the media, which is ferociously hostile to the protests. They're not being driven by a sense that we should negotiate in good faith with the students. That never happened on the Columbia campus.
Well, what about the allegations that some of the protests or parts of the protests were anti-Semitic?
I mean, there were things that were said against Jews, especially in protests off campus, for which the students have no responsibility. Almost everything that was cited that was, in fact, anti-Semitic was taking place off campus with demonstrators that had nothing to do with the students. I think, frankly, that that's a cover in some cases for arguments and statements and slogans used by students, which are being falsely interpreted as anti-Semitic. We are being told that the term intifada is anti-Semitic. Intifada means an uprising against a 57-year-old in June. Illegal, violent occupation. What's anti-Semitic about that? If the occupiers were Danes and Christian Danes, would uprising against their occupation be anti-Christian? It's absolutely absurd. Intifada means uprising against a violent occupation. There's nothing anti-Semitic in that, unless you consider that Judaism is somehow related to violent military occupation, which, of course, it is not. So I think these are slogans that are falsely being interpreted as quote-unquote anti-Semitic, when in fact they are critiques of Israel's policy.
Can I ask you finally, you say you're an historian and you can't predict the future, but certainly, as you know better than most, history teaches us what is possible. And in terms of, you're looking at the Israeli government and politics moving to the right. You've analysed what has happened since October the 7th and before that, in recent times. I just wonder what you think is possible in terms of a timeline to find some sort of peaceful resolution here.
Look, I think that it may take a while. I don't know how long it'll take. But I think sooner or later there are two peoples there that have to reconcile. And they have to reconcile on a basis of recognizing historical realities. In Ireland, you were not able to overcome the history of 850 years of British colonialism until people recognized the harm that was done by that. It was absolutely essential to the Northern Ireland peace process, and it was essential to the establishment of the Republic of the Free State in 1921. You don't have a resolution without the recognition of past historical harms. Queen Elizabeth came and recognized that in Ireland, and that turned the page, I think. In Ireland, the same kind of thing is going to be necessary in Palestine. You have to have a solution based on justice where everybody has equal rights. You achieved that in Northern Ireland thanks to the Good Friday Agreement. And hopefully that will lead to a better future for everybody in the entirety of the island. I hope that Ireland and perhaps even South Africa can be examples of how one way or another these two peoples can figure out how to live together in this very small country.
Okay, I hope you're right. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I must say, Professor Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much indeed for joining us in Drive Time.
Thank you, Cormac.